Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another program of the INSS podcast series. My name is Adi Kantor, and today we dedicate our program to discuss the issue of American anti-Semitism in its historical context. In January 2020, marking 75 years to the liberation of Auschwitz, Professor Deborah Lipstadt, the distinguished American historian who was lately also appointed by President Biden to be the United States Special Envoy for Monitoring and Combating Anti-Semitism, was quoted saying, "We expected that the Holocaust will make anti-Semitism unacceptable. We were wrong. Teaching about the Holocaust is not an antidote to anti-Semitism. It no longer serves as a vaccine against anti-Semitism." End of quote. In June 2021, according to ADL poll, 3/4 of U.S. Jews have expressed concern over anti-Semitism in the country. What are the historical origins of the discourse surrounding American anti-Semitism? How has the phenomenon developed in the past 100 years? Has it changed with time? If so, in what way? What is different in American anti-Semitism when compared to other forms of bigotry? Also, when comparing to other countries around the world, what were the main formative events in the history of American anti-Semitism throughout the 20th century, and what were the counter-reactions by the American Jewish community? In order to discuss these issues in depth, I have the privilege and honor to host Professor Eli Lederhandler in today's show. Professor Lederhandler is a Stephen S. Weiss Professor of American Jewish History and Institutions at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and the chair of the Department of Jewish History and Contemporary Jewry. He is a modern historian who teaches on the American and European Jewish experience. His research interests include Jewish political history, Jews and the history of international migrations, and the history of economic relations in Jewish society. Among his major publications are The Road of Modern Jewish Politics, published in 1989, New York Jews and the Decline of Urban Ethnicity, 1950 to 1970, published in 2001, Jewish Immigrants and American Capitalism, 1880 to 1920, published in 2009, and his latest book published in 2016, American Jewry, A New History. In August this year, Professor Lederhandler published an article titled American Anti-Semitism in its Historical and Social Background, which was a publication in the framework of the INSS collection of articles on contemporary anti-Semitism in the United States. While most of the articles published in this series focused on the contemporary discourse surrounding anti-Semitism in the US, Professor Lederhandler's article sheds a light on the broader social historical perspective on the phenomenon, which serves as a great contribution to our understanding of it today. In his article, he examines the phenomenon of anti-Semitism in the United States in the context of American social history and analyzes how the phenomenon has developed in the United States over the past 100 years, emphasizing the main formative events and counter-reactions by the American Jewish community. Good morning to you, Professor Eli Lederhandler. It is an honor to have you as our guest in the program, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Good morning to you, too.
So let us begin, first of all, by addressing the historical context when discussing American anti-Semitism and its social background. When comparing to other political and legal systems, particularly in Europe, what is, in your view, what is different in the American, what you quote in your article, American system of government and justice that prevents it from collapsing into anarchy and fascism, which may come due to domestic and social crisis. You also make the distinction, as I recall in your article, between America as a set of social actors and America as a state. You make a very clear distinction when discussing this. Before we dive into the Jewish experience, first of all, the system. Can you please elaborate a bit more about this?
Sure. Look, it's a sort of a well-known trope in American studies to speak about American exceptionalism. It's been critiqued by many observers, but essentially the fact remains that the United States is one of the very few places on earth where there has been no constitutional or regime change in over 200 years. In fact, more than that, because even under the colonial British regime, the same, relatively speaking, the same system of laws, justice, and government prevailed, so that we can extend that 230 years even further back in history. That kind of political stability is rare. It does speak to a certain robustness of the prevailing system of government, the system of justice, and the protection of individual rights. And that really is the basis of much of the American system of government, unlike many other societies in which a great deal of weight is given to the idea of a national collective, which takes, as it were, priority or supremacy over the individual. And with all of its flaws, and the United States certainly is a system and a society with plenty of flaws, but the idea of the sacredness of individual rights is something that is shared by both the right and the left in American politics, which does set it apart from many other societies in the past and political systems even up to the present. It's a republic without any pre-liberal past to hanker after or to be nostalgic about. There's no established church. It's a two-party system without proportional representation, which makes it a lot harder for splinter parties or third parties to edge their way into legislative seats in either at the state's level or at the federal level, and there's no real option in the United States as it exists and based on its system of government. There's no real option for kind of a corporatist, collectivist union around one single divisive issue. And I think aside from the actual structure of the American system, when one talks about how is it that very strong divisive forces that surely have existed in the past as they exist today, in the United States, as pretty much everywhere else, how is it that those divisive forces have not led to a drastic change of constitution or regime, as has obviously happened in most other countries of the world? Mm-hmm. And part of the reason is one that can be called the cross-hatching of different divisions. There are so many divisions in a large society, a very heterogeneous society like that of the United States, where there is racial, class, ethnic, religious, and regional differences between people and between different parts of society. And no single divisive issue has ever served to rally, as it were, a large part of the country around one divisive issue. And it's usually in, as we learn from Jewish history, it's usually the case when one divisive and decisive issue prevails in a political system that Jews become a kind of political football between the pros and the cons. And the fact that there isn't just one pro or one con means that the chances for one particular group to become a political football between two sides is minimized. So there, in a nutshell, I would summarize it that way.
Thank you. And this exactly serves as a really introduction to what we are diving now into, which is really the anti-Semitic discourse that has been that has developed in the past 100 years. And you say that what is different in the American case is that this, I quote from your article, the sting of American anti-Semitism stems from the fact that it calls out members of the Jewish community for their elite status. And you add that in spite of the fact that for 370 years of Jewish life in America, quote, American anti-Semitism has punctuated at times by intermittent outbursts of violent acts against Jews or Jewish property, ideas, words, or deeds directed against American Jewish population have not assumed the form of publicly sanctioned and legalized discrimination or violence that other American groups, primarily Native Americans and African Americans, have suffered. So you clearly make a distinction here between the Jewish minority and other minorities. And I really wonder, in your view, what is different? What is different in the American anti-Semitism when compared to other forms of bigotry? And later, maybe if you can refer to really how has it developed in let's say the beginning of the 20th century, and then after the second half of the 20th century, it will be, I think, interesting and informative to know what has changed, if at all.
Well, that's a very big question, and I'll try to, or two questions. As I alluded to in the article, and as you mentioned, one of the key differences between anti-Semitism in its American form and other forms of antagonism, hostility, hatred directed against other groups in the United States over history and up to the present. One of the key differences is that in the case of anti-Semitism, it has only a social history. At any time in the past, risen to the level of state anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. No laws of discrimination were ever passed by any government at any level in the United States. Or previously, before the United States became independent, no law discriminated against Jews at the civil level. Jews had always lived as equals among other white people in the United States. They were considered part of the majority society, even though their religion obviously was different. Mm-hmm. And no arm of law enforcement or the military or the judiciary has ever participated in any act of violence or expropriation directed against Jews, with one very, very small exception that never actually came to be. This is the famous Order Number 11 by General Ulysses S. Grant during the Civil War, in which he ordered the deportation of Jews from a part of the area under his military government, but it was countermanded immediately by President Lincoln. That exception is the exception that proves the rule. And this contrasts so sharply with the forms of state discrimination that has been, and even at worst, actual violence, mass violence, even genocide that has been practiced in the United States against other groups, not to mention the history of the Jews in other countries of the world. So there is, once again, you know, a strong case to be made that, yes, there's anti-Semitism in American, in the American scene. There's always been anti-Semitism, it's always been around, but it's been around at a certain level of discourse, that social level of discourse that has never risen to the level of state policy. And in fact, I would put it more strongly than that. You won't find American representatives of government or the legal system who have ever come out publicly in support of anti-Jewish discrimination. So I think it's fair to say that anti-Semitism in the United States is a kind of anti-Semitism on the back burner. It's on the low boil, excuse me. And that may be one of the most interesting points to take away from our contemporary observations about what's going on in our world today, that we're not dealing with the 1930s here. We're not dealing with state anti-Semitism practiced by totalitarian regimes. What we're seeing is anti-Semitism in democracies, that is to say, functioning strong democracies in which, nevertheless, anti-Semitic opinions are frequently being raised, but they're not being raised at the state level. And this is a new reality in which I think we have to understand the rules of the game.
And when, with your permission, when they are raised, they're raised against Jews, comparing them to seeing them as an elite group. And this, you say in the article, is what makes it maybe unique when compared to other minority groups. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Okay. Look, there was a time, if you're asking me as a historian, looking back at the turn of the 20th century, that is the turn from the 19th to the 20th century, a period of mass migration into the United States, including obviously the mass migration of Jews into the United States, about 2.25 million who came from Eastern Europe, many of whom were very poor and members of the working class. And at that time, some part of the anti-Semitic discourse in the United States related to those Jews, those new immigrant Jews, as more or less the unwashed masses, the sort of uncivilized, savage people coming out of, you know, the back provinces of a despotic Russian Empire, who would never, in the terms of this discourse, never be able to assimilate properly, never be able to adjust properly to the American way of life. So the discourse at the time was less focused on what today is known as Jewish privilege, and much more focused on the dangers, as it were, of Jews entering and corroding or corrupting the American way of life from the urban slums and the tenements of those days. That's no longer the case, because most American Jews today, as we know, enjoy a fairly affluent lifestyle. Not all of them, but most of them, certainly compared with most other population groups in American society. And what's been happening lately, as I believe we can see, is that although there's an anti-Semitic discourse that's out there, very often it's claimed that, well, you know, Jews don't really have a right to protest against that because they can always assert their privilege. They are a white privileged group, and therefore they have, as it were, no moral right to complain if people say nasty things about them.
What are the origins to this assumption that Jews, for example, Jews as whites or privileged whites or elite group, where does it come from in the US context?
Well, that's got a complicated history. You know, way back when the American Republic was founded, it was stipulated in the immigration law of the time, mm-hmm, that immigration to the United States would be free for all free white people. That is to say, the importation of non-white slaves was something that was going to be limited and in the end abolished. Immigration of non-white people was not going to be permitted. And yet, as we know from history, Jews always immigrated to the United States, as did nearly all other population groups stemming from Europe. That means that in practice, as well as in legal practice, Jews were considered white, along with all other European-born people. And in fact, I would go further. When it began to be noticed that Jews were immigrating to the United States from parts of the Ottoman Turkish Empire of that time, such as Syria, Turkey, and so forth, Palestine, the question was raised, are these also the same? Are these Jews white? And eventually the determination was made that, well, yes, because they're Jews, they belong to a group that is already part of the American melting pot, already part of the recognized stream of legal immigration. Now, that being said, you know, that Jews were considered white under the law as far as immigration is concerned. That being said, it should also be noted that around the turn of the 20th century, there was a whole stream of thought in anthropology, both in the United States and in Europe, obviously, that began to make distinctions, as it were, quasi-racial distinctions between different population groups from Europe. So that, for example, South Italians were considered racially different from Northern Italians, and so on. Jews were being considered as a racially coherent group, as it were. Excuse me.
Can you give some examples of historical events that you say, okay, this marks a change in the discourse?
Well, we're talking about
before or after World War I, or before, 20s, 30s, some examples?
Yeah. Sure. Look, at the time that I'm referring to, the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, was the time of a pseudo-scientific movement at the highest academic level that enshrined the idea of genetically different, racially different populations and graded them on a kind of hierarchy in which, surprise, surprise, white Protestant Northern Europeans were graded highest, and everybody else came further down in the pecking order, including Jews who were labeled at the time as Hebrews. That being said, it should be pointed out that this sort of classification of different European peoples according to their genetic desirability did penetrate the social and intellectual discourse at the time, but it didn't result in any specific discrimination against those people in the United States. In other words, once you were in, you were in. The question was going to be, were they going to let you in? And what happened in the end, as we know, is that by 1921, the United States decided it was worth it to try and limit the ongoing immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, which had been so massive over the course of the previous 30 or 40 years. And that limitation, according to where you were from, the famous quota system based on national origins, that could certainly be seen as a reflection of that sort of point of view that some people from Europe were whiter than others and therefore more desirable than others. And Jews didn't fit in the whitest of the white category. So that's, you know, the way you're historically speaking, the sort of idea that Jews form part of the privileged majority. You have to be aware that there were some periods in which that was not really the case.
The 30s, right, before World War II, and then you see definitely a change after 1945. The Holocaust definitely influenced the discourse in the U.S. Right?
It was partly the after effects of the American encounter with Nazi racism and the Holocaust. That was part of what delegitimized this sort of discourse about the racialization of European groups. And Jews in particular, of course. But it was more than that. I think one has to take into account that by the time we reached the 1940s and 50s, there are two other things going on. One is that the majority of the Jewish community in the United States is achieving middle class economic and professional status. And that already gave them a kind of an edge, a leg up over less privileged groups in the United States. And this idea that Jews are becoming part of majority society, part of the more privileged ranks in American society, does take its roots from the social reality of the time of the 1950s and on into the 60s, when Jews really did enjoy certain social advantages, including higher education and higher average incomes.
They were also compared to communism. I mean, we're talking about the Cold War, right? We're diving into the Cold War. How has this affected the relations between Jews and non-Jews?
Well, you know, that's a fascinating chapter. And here again, I would have to go back to what I said a minute ago about middle class status.
Yeah.
The more middle class the Jews became, the less of a perceived threat they could be as a kind of a fifth column of insurgent communists just waiting to take over. It was very instructive, in fact, during the early 1950s, and the particular event that stands out is the espionage trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were, as we know, convicted and sentenced to death and executed for their role in passing atomic secrets to the Soviets during the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And if at any time in American history, it would have been a potential danger for Jews to be associated not only with communism in general, but with treason specifically, that would have been the time. And, you know, but the shoe didn't drop, as it were. If one shoe dropped with the Rosenbergs going to the execution chamber, the second shoe never dropped. McCarthyism as a anti-communist political movement, as we know, did affect Americans at large, and did affect certain groups of Jews, such as the Jews who were active in Hollywood, in terms of being blacklisted from their jobs and so forth. But it was never directed. McCarthyism and the Cold War anti-communism of the time was never actually directed against Jews per se. And so guess what? You know, the pogrom never happened.
Yes. Yes, I am. With the last minutes that we have left, I'd like to discuss with you more really from the Jewish side, the Jewish American side, and their reactions, the counter reactions. And you, I quote from your article again, you say the Jews have helped to create Americans' image of America as America that includes and does not exclude Jews. I was wondering what you meant by this sentence. Maybe you can elaborate more on that. And which brings me also to the counter reaction. How have American Jews reacted to the discrimination pointed against them? You say it was, we cannot compare it to what they have experienced, of course, in Europe. So with the American special case, how did Jews react?
Okay, how is it that Jews became, you know, part of the sort of the chattering classes, the opinion makers in the United States? Well, you know, look at how many Jews are professionally active in the media and in the academic professions and in popular culture. When I said in the article that Jews helped shape the image of America, that was what I was referring to. Hollywood created the Wild West in American cinema. Emma Lazarus, the Jewish American poet, is so famous because of the sonnet at the base of the Statue of Liberty. There were so many ways in which the American view of itself has had Jewish input. The anthem, God Bless America, was written by a Jew. There are so many ways in which one could, you know, tease out this point about Jews having shaped Americans' views of America itself. And that's not to say that Jews can control the media or that Jews can control how Jews are perceived, but they can control to some extent, or control is the wrong word, influence. Right. The Jews have had an impact far beyond their numbers on the way America perceives itself. And the way America perceives itself is an America that includes Jews, and that cannot be erased. That's, you know, as far as that's concerned. And as far as your other question about how Jews have responded, in some ways, it's clear that Jews have in the United States responded over the decades to episodes of antisemitism in fairly similar ways to what we see in other countries. That is, first, Jews self-organize. They when there's a perceived threat, Jews tend to organize themselves to counter that threat. They do so by counter-propaganda. They do so by fighting to make discrimination illegal. This was more true in the past when there was a matter to be, a cause to be fought against social discrimination in universities of high caliber and that sort of thing. Excuse me. But Jews in the United States have also done something that doesn't really exist so much in other countries, and that is Jews in the United States have tended to make common cause with those considered socially and economically less advantaged, downward, down the social scale.
You talk about the minority mentality.
The minority mentality.
Downward, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That is part of the arsenal of Jewish defense, self-defense in American society, which I think is rare to find in most other historical cases, although it's beginning to show up in some places around the world today as well. Mm-hmm. But it was it's certainly an entrenched pattern among American Jews that by fighting the cause of those less or least advantaged, one also fights the cause in general for a better, more liberal, more open and tolerant society in principle. Yeah. And that cannot help but be also somewhat advantageous for Jews who may feel themselves under pressure.
Sure. I'd like to conclude really our final question. Unfortunately, we are limited in time. We could continue for hours, but I really, before we conclude, when discussing anti-Semitism today in the U.S., I was wondering what your views are on this issue. How alarming is the situation there today? I'm asking you as an historian, you have a comparative view, of course, to other times. You mentioned in the article in the last chapter, you mentioned, of course, the issue of Israel and the dissonance. I'm really interested in this. You claim that the Jews, American Jews, are in a impossible dissonance at the moment in the discourse, and on the one hand wanting to be part, of course, of the American society, on the other hand, of course, Israel matters to them very, very much. Your final words on this issue? I know it's impossible to say final words on this, but still.
I'll try. I'll start with the last point, the dissonance. As is well known, the majority of American Jewish voters tend to vote for liberal causes and liberal candidates. They identify broadly with the liberal agenda, which emphasizes individual freedoms and rights, the dignity of human beings at home and abroad. They identify with equality, tolerance, and so forth. And the liberal camp is for, and certainly the Democratic Party, as a kind of a proxy in many cases for the liberal camp, is considered by many Jews to be their home turf. Mm-hmm. Not all, but most. Mm-hmm. And that being the case, it makes it somewhat uncomfortable to be at one and the same time identified with the liberal agenda and the liberal political camp and the discourses that support that agenda, including at college campuses and among students and faculty and in the media. It's difficult to be at one and the same time perceived as part of a liberal coalition, and at the same time being called upon to defend policies or acts that that same liberal camp often depicts as illiberal.
Right.
I'm not going to relate in the few seconds that we have left to whether that's a correct perception or not. I'm talking about the perception itself.
Yes.
The perception that Israel's state policies, since 1967, contain a problematic issue, namely the Palestinian residents of the territories that Israel occupied in 1967. That issue has grown, mushroomed over time, as we well know, to become a sort of a litmus test of international liberalism, not only in the United States, but also in the United States. And this is where I think Jews in the United States, in the sphere of public opinion, are beginning to feel less comfortable. Mm-hmm. Although, with one last word of caution, this is less the case in the United States than it is true in other countries such as England or elsewhere.
The United States, of course, we saw that in there.
Mm-hmm. Correct. I think even just from the past few days, the Bennett-Biden discussions and statements do reinforce the reality that in American public opinion, there still is a large degree of support. Very widespread support in American public opinion for Israel that makes it more comfortable for Jews to be active in the public sphere.
Sure. Professor Lederenlo, I'd like to thank you very, very much for sharing with us your views on such a complicated issue such as anti-Semitism in the U.S. from its historical, social perspective, and definitely also the what it is today. We will need, of course, more hours to cover this issue. I really want to thank you for your time, and thank you very much for the audience also that that listened to us. Thank you very much, and Shana Tova.
Shana Tova to you. Bye-bye.